the UCR Podcast.
Regular listeners of this podcast will recall that I said you were all in for a treat in the last episode, and that general thought carries over into today's edition, the second of three interviews I did talking about the career of Dan Fogelberg. You know Dan's music in part because of his big hits like Leader of the Band, Same Old Lang Syne, Longer, and The Language of Love, just to name a few. Dan has played with some powerhouse musicians over the years, including drummer and multi-instrumentalist Joe Vitale. Joe spent a bunch of years playing with all sorts of folks, including Joe Walsh, who he still works with, Crosby, Stills, and Nash, and a lot of their extended musical family tree, Peter Frampton, and many, many more, so many more, in fact, that Joe and his wife, Susie, put together a book here in the past couple of decades called Backstage Pass, Stories from the Road and in the Studio with Crosby, Stills, and Nash, Dan Fogelberg, Peter Frampton, The Eagles, Ted Nugent, Joe Walsh, Neil Young, and many more. You can get your own copy at Joe's website, joevitaleondrums.com. I got it at the time it was published in 2008, and folks, this book is astounding. We are just going to scratch the surface in today's conversation when it comes to everything that Joe has done over the years, but I think you're really going to enjoy his stories, including his recollections of something that happened after he put out the book when he got the chance to play drums for the reunited Buffalo Springfield, and that is a gig I wish I would have been able to attend. I kick myself every day for missing that short run of dates, including their incredible performance at Bonnaroo. Joe will be part of Friends and Legends 2026, a Dan Fogelberg celebration weekend in Peoria, Illinois, which will have a number of exciting events, including an appearance by legendary photographer Henry Diltz, who will share a specially curated presentation of his photography of Dan from over the years. The Fogelberg Foundation is also getting the members of Dan's 2002 touring band back together for a special evening of music and memories featuring guitarist Robert McEntee, keyboardist Michael Hanna, Mark Andes on bass, Joe on the drums, plus special guests. The weekend's events are a celebration of a new Dan Fogelberg exhibit at the Peoria Riverfront Museum, and I'm glad I got a chance to speak with Joe Vitale in advance of everything happening next weekend. Fogelberg.rocks is where you can learn about the Dan Fogelberg Celebration Weekend schedule of events happening April 17th, 18th, and 19th. It is Matt Wardlaw. I spoke with Joe Vitale, but I also spoke with Eric Mills of the Fogelberg Foundation for a deep dive into Dan's career. That is our previous episode, if you missed that, and I'm probably going to have at least one more interview to share with you all featuring bassist Mark Andes, who played with Dan, and you also know Mark from his work with Heart, Spirit, Firefall, JoJo Gunn, and others. If this is your first time hearing the UCR podcast, please follow wherever you're listening so you'll get future episodes as they're released. And I think this is the third or fourth time I've had the pleasure of speaking with Joe Vitale, and I think you folks are really going to dig today's conversation. One final note, Joe mentions the Rock and Roll Fantasy Camp coming up later this month, and if that's of interest to any of you out there for a good road trip, check out more details on that at rockcamp.com. All right, folks, let's get into this. Enjoy this conversation with the great Joe Vitale. How did you first come across Dan Fogelberg, and how do you guys end up meeting?
Well, Dan and Irv Azoff were from the same area. They grew up together, and they worked together. And then Irv Azoff started to manage Joe Walsh and Barnstorm, and we met Dan, and Joe was to produce his first record. And so Dan jumped on board our station wagon we were touring it with, and drove around the country with us for a couple of weeks. And he brought his cassettes. And I mean, I really didn't know who this guy was. He was some kind of hippie guy, and a young hippie guy. And but he put his cassettes in the car player, and it was like, whoa, who is this guy? Listen to that voice. And so we became very, very good friends, and Joe proceeded to produce his record. And Irving hooked us up with him, Walsh up with him. But I was there because I was touring with Joe. And so we got to meet Dan, and it was really kind of cool to hang with him for those 2 weeks on the road, and learned a lot about him, and his music was just incredible. And I don't know how he made these demos, probably like a little four-track cassette player or something. And then we stayed in good communication for years and years. And when I could do tours, I toured with him, and it was either me or Russ Kunkel or whoever. And then even when Russ Kunkel played one of the tours, I was an extra keyboard player and did some flute for him and percussion. And so he kept us all working for a long time. And his tours were always amazing. They were sold out, and he was just stellar every night. And the band was always good. And it was really, really great touring with him.
Was the touring with Dan, was that kind of one of the first times that you, because you mentioned that there was a tour like where Russ, you know, did the tour and you were out there playing keyboards. Was that one of the first times, like, I know you play, you know, multiple instruments, and that's one thing folks should know about you is that you are not just a drummer, but was the Fogelberg thing one of the first times you'd really gone out, like, not playing drums and instead playing keyboards?
It was, and that was just, it was totally different, but just as enjoyable. And, you know, me and Russ Kunkel are good friends, and we knew each other, you know, for years, and great guy, great drummer. And Dan would call me, and he said, "Hey, I need you to go out in the road." And I said, "Okay." He says, "Russ Kunkel's going to go." I said, "What do you want me to do?" So he said, "Can you want to play some keys and percussion and some flute?" And I said, "Well, sure." And so, yeah, it was really different because it was the first time in my life I'd ever gone on a tour and not played drums. But it wasn't anything that was weird. It was just different. That's all.
I've always kind of wondered with you, you know, playing the different instruments that you do, flute and keys and drums, like, how do those things kind of feed each other, do you think, as a creative person? Like, you know, because I always like hear the story of, like, for instance, like Steven Tyler started out as a drummer, and you can hear that his lyrics are kind of percussive as a result. So I just wonder, like, you doing what you do, like, how, you know, those different instruments kind of fed your approach to each one, if at all.
Well, just like Steven Tyler, when I play keys, it's just a melodic drum to me, you know. And I play with rhythm in the keys, and same with flute. And I mean, I learned that from Don Henley years ago, that, you know, he could stop playing, and his vocal alone, you could feel the groove in the pocket. He's always in the pocket. Drummers are like that. I think Phil Collins is like that. Definitely Ringo's like that. So many guys that play drums and sing, their vocals are like solidly in the pocket. And I guess we can't get away from being a drummer first, you know. And that being said, I still had to learn parts that were on Dan's records. So, you know, I made it my own, and I had a great time doing that. It was really fun.
What attracted you to the flute originally? Because it's such a cool instrument.
What attracted me to it was years and years ago, I was a huge fan, still am, a huge fan of the band Traffic.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah, with Steve Winwood, and they had a flute player, and I really liked that whole sound, and Joe Walsh liked that sound. We did some stuff with Joe on records that had flute, and I don't know, it was a challenge. I think that was the reason I started. It was because it was so different than what I was used to doing, and I had already, you know, studied enough piano that I could learn another instrument. I took my time. I didn't just overnight was able to play. It took a while. Some of those early bands, like Jethro Tull, I loved. And like I said, Traffic. It was such a different approach to music than the drums or keys. I mean, it was a whole nother world. I'm still learning that instrument, by the way. You know, I don't try to think I'm a flautist, you know, but I can play a little bit, you know.
I think that's kind of a natural thing from what I've come to know when it comes to creative people that are musicians, is they're always obviously looking to keep challenging themselves. And I remember talking at one point to some folks that were out kind of doing a, you know, Bob Dylan, Rolling Thunder review kind of thing, where they would all switch off on each other's songs through the night. And one of the things that they've been doing with the idle time on the road was they were all trying to learn different instruments. So, you know, you had the drummer learning to, you know, play, I don't know, bass or whatever the case is. So they were all trying different things. I thought that was pretty cool.
It's challenging, but it's real healthy. I think it's great. Because you also, when you mess with another instrument, you kind of have a lot of appreciation for the people that actually play those instruments. And also when you're writing songs, you have a little more insight on, okay, what am I hearing that the bass player could play on this, you know? And so it gives you some insight on other instruments, and you don't always have to be, you know, an amazing player on other instruments. All you have to do is understand the instrument and play a little bit and play enough for it to be a tool to help you in writing and stuff. And that really helped me. That's how I started playing keys, because my first local bands in Ohio, when we were teenagers, one of the guys in the band, we played nothing but, you know, covers, songs that were on the radio. And one of the jobs of one of the guys in the band was to write the lyrics down. And another job available was, all right, somebody's got to write down the chords and the music part of this stuff. And I said, well, okay, I will. We always had a piano in our house, so I started learning that way back then. And my father was a musician, a keyboard player, and he insisted that he said, you play the drums, that's great, but I want you to learn a little bit of piano, because you need to know a little piano. And that was the best advice I could have ever gotten. And so way back then, I was learning all these songs on keys. And as you know, when you learn songs on keys, you're actually teaching yourself how to play keyboards. And you also, the coolest thing about learning another instrument is when you work out other people's songs, you get a really good bird's eye view of where this guy was at, where his head was at when he wrote these songs. And you get, wow, I never thought of using that chord and that melody. And you know how it goes. And you're learning how, I mean, so my first attempt, a challenging attempt was back then, was I was a huge fan of the Beach Boys. So I loved Brian Wilson. He was a genius. And I had to sit down and learn all those songs he wrote. And you really get a huge respect for the people that write these kind of songs. And then because you struggle through trying to learn them. And it's a good education.
Yeah, I was thinking about that as you were talking about kind of getting inside somebody's head, doing it in that way. And it must have been pretty interesting for you, kind of getting inside the proverbial head of, you know, Dan Fogelberg as a creative person and a fellow artist and writer.
Oh, absolutely. His melodies and, oh, geez, he just beautiful melodies and words and, you know, what an artist he was. He was a real true artist. And he could rock too. You know, I mean, he did all the beautiful love ballads and all the pretty beautiful songs, but we once did a thing for 2 weeks. It was one of the most fun things that I ever did with Dan. Was we were called Frankie and the Aliens. And it was his road touring band, me on drums on that one. And he wanted to go out, and he hadn't toured in a while, maybe a year. And he wanted to get his chops built up and his voice built up and all that. So he got us all together, the same band that went on the road with him, and we went out for 2 weeks. We played all these like bars and like kind of dives in Colorado, and we got on a bus and just went from one nightclub or bar to they were pretty funky, but people were great, and we would play for 2.5 hours, and he would just build all his vocal chops and guitar playing. And we never did one single Dan Fogelberg song. A lot of people didn't even know it was him. They just thought we were some, you know, rock and roll blues band or something. And he loved he loved B.B. King, and so we did a lot of blues, and we just warming up for a tour, and so I got to see a whole nother side of Dan, you know, that, you know, I knew he was a great player, but I had never really played much with him when he was, like, we were doing, like, Born Under a Bad Sign or stuff like that, and he could sing the heck out of it and play the heck out of it, you know, and boy, that was fun 2 weeks.
Yeah, I think people understand when you hear stories like that why, like, the Stones, you know, always start off
That's
the tour
right.
playing like those yeah. really little places, because, man, those bars and dives you're talking about, there's no better way to get from where I'm sitting, there's no better way to get a band primed than doing that, what you and Dan and everybody did in a place like that.
Yeah, I remember walking in this one club in some mountain town, little nothing mountain town in Colorado, up way up in the mountain, and we walked in the bar to set up, and there was a guy, it must have been hunting. He had his rifle with him, and it was, you know, all cool. If you knew those people, that was all cool. He has a rifle with him sitting on the bar there. He looked at us, and he said, "Y'all better be good."
Amazing.
Yeah, it put the fear of God in us, man. But he ended up he was drinking and dancing all night, and he had a good time.
What was the experience of being in the studio with Dan?
Oh, just totally amazing. He's so focused. He was very easy to record with because he knew exactly what he was looking for. And obviously, he always let us stretch out a little and try things and all that. And half the time, he'd love it. And half the time, he'd go, "Well, let's go back to the other way," or something, you know. He was very easy to work with in the studio because he had a really clear direction as to what he wanted from you. And that really helps, because I've made a lot of records in my life. And sometimes, you know, we can't read people's minds. And sometimes it's very frustrating to chase ideas around in a studio all day. And they can't come up with a decision. He decided he knew what he wanted. And like I said, he always gave us room to stretch a little and maybe our take on it, you know, and he was always wanting to hear that. And so he was very, very comfortable and easy to record with him.
I want people to know, if they don't know, that you have the book, Joe Vitale, Backstage Pass, as told to Susie Vitale. And when you say that you've made a lot of records in your life, there's close to 400 pages about all the experiences of records and tours and otherwise. That had to be, at some point, overwhelming once that project was done. And you've done more records and lots more gigs since then, but it had to be pretty overwhelming to take stock of that at that point when you're staring at this big book in front of you.
Well, it was. My wife did such a good job on it. It took 3 years to do it, and we've got, there's like over 700 photos in the book, and those are what helped us get through all the stories. When you look at a photo, it really stirs up the memory of, oh, okay, now I remember. And also it puts things in a nice timeline, because you think that, oh, I remember when I did that. And then you find the photos like, oh, wait a minute. No, I was wrong. That was a year later. You know, the photos really say a lot. And I used to write on the back of photos and as to when, where, whatever, and the tour or whatever. And we went through 10,000 photos easy. And going through all that really was helpful in determining a timeline and a personnel choices, who they were and when it was. Because after 30, 40 years ago on a tour, or 20 years ago on a tour, it's very difficult to remember some of this stuff. But I've got all my tour books. That was helpful. But actually, the photos really came in handy. And once we got started, I never wanted to do it because I thought it was just going to be an overwhelming. I would have never been able to do it myself. But I sat for a couple of years, and we went over stories, and my wife would record everything that I was talking about, and then we had photos to compare, and so. Yeah, it came out real good, and done a lot since then. I think pretty soon we're about ready for book two, I guess. I don't know.
I would say so, man. Yeah, absolutely. How did you become a guy that was out there, you know, taking photographs like that?
Well, you know, we didn't have cell phones. Well, I'd have had way more photos, but we had, you know, we had our little 35 millimeter cameras. And actually, in the very, very early days, we had less quality cameras than that. But once they made cameras small enough that had took 35 millimeter film, you know, we always had a camera in our bag, you know, and we do a lot of traveling. And in the early days, I was going to places I had never been. And so it was always cool to take photos of that. And as time went on, you know, I've been to, you know, Chicago 100 times, you know, but there's always, you know, you've been to all these cities many tens of times. And but there was always something to take a photo of, you know, and especially like sound check backstage on the bus at the airport, you know, that kind of stuff, on us being silly idiots, you know, and doing stupid things. And, everybody kind of took photos back then. I mean, we didn't have cell phones, or like I said, that there would have been a massive amount of photos and video. And that's the one thing we lacked in the early touring days in the 70s and on into the 80s, is we didn't have video available to us until like the, you know, nobody wanted to drag a Betamax or a VHS camera around with them. They were so damn big.
And heavy.
And heavy, yes. And so we didn't have a lot of that. And now my son has a lot of video from VHS stuff because that he's converting over to digital, because my wife and my son would come out on gigs on tours. I mean, they always had the camera with them, and my son took a ton of video. So he's in the midst right now of converting a lot of the stuff. There's some really pretty cool stuff out there that he's doing. And, but I never had a video camera. You know, like I said, it was bulky and heavy, and I didn't have room for it.
You know, you talk about those cities like a Chicago that you went to so many times. And I heard an interview recently with Jerry Beckley, and he was talking about kind of learning where your music is popular. And he said he's still having those kind of realizations since he kind of stepped away from touring with America. He said he and his wife went to Scandinavia in recent times. And he's like, I realized I'd never been there because America never got an offer to come play there. So our music was not popular there. So are there places you still haven't been? Because you've been a lot of places. Is there places still on the bucket list for Joe?
Well, yeah. I mean, I still would like to go to the Middle East, but that's a little bit scary right now.
Sure. Yeah.
I've been to many, many countries around the world and been to all the states in America, but, there's places I really don't care to go. I have no desire to go to some places, and it's too scary, too much turmoil, and I don't need that. And so yeah. I'll look at photos, you know, if somebody else took. But I've never been to Egypt. I'd love to go to Egypt. I would love to go to Israel. Just like I say, the Middle East is fascinating to me. And we were supposed to play a gig in, this was like 15 years ago or something. We were supposed to do a gig with Crosby, Stills, and Nash in Jerusalem. And I was really looking forward to that because I had never been to Israel. But last minute, they canceled it because they were getting bombed. So it's like, okay, we're not going there. Yeah. And so it's sad. It's so much turmoil in these really old, ancient, historic places. And so that's still on my bucket list, some of those kind of places. But there's other places I've been, you know, that it was incredible to go. But there's some of them that I really don't need to go back. I've been there a few times. And also, it's not always that fun to go by yourself. I was with a band, you know, but it's good to share it with your family and stuff. So that we still like to go places and all that. But, you know, the way the world is, I'm comfortable just staying right here at home.
That makes sense.
I don't mean home. I mean in America. There's plenty to see in America.
Yeah. Well, leaving home within America, you're going to be playing with Michael Hanna, Mark Andes, and Robert McEntee, the Wayward Exiles, as you guys called yourselves last year, when you guys ended up revisiting a bunch of Dan's music for the CD release, The Minstrel, The Melodies of Dan Fogelberg. And that seems like that must have been a really cool experience, revisiting the songs in that way.
It was really cool because we had never approached them like that. And Eric Mills and Robert McEntee had this idea to do this. It was brilliant and it was really fun and really heartwarming because you revisited stuff that you forgot just how beautiful his writing was. And, you know, of course, they were instrumentals and they were a whole different vibe to the song, but they were still his melodies and chords and all that stuff. And so, but you really, we appreciated and respected him all over again by doing some of his stuff instrumentally. And it was a little bit softer and acoustic and just as mellow and just beautiful arrangements. And so, you know, it came out of nowhere. I got this phone call from Robert. He goes, "Hey, are you interested in doing something like this?" I said, "Hell yeah, that sounds like an incredible project." And so we pulled it off, and it's a very, very cool piece of music.
Well, I know that fans are looking forward to seeing what sort of rabbits you guys are going to pull out of the hat with this show in Peoria, man. It must be a lot of fun getting ready to do this thing.
Oh, yeah. I've been going over this stuff, and I know the material pretty good, but, you know, it's been a while, and so you have to refresh and go over it again. But the band will be great because these guys are all still playing and healthy, and we're older, but we're still at it. So it's going to be really good.
Yeah, it's been cool, you know, locally here in Ohio, seeing what you've been doing, you know, with Joe Jr. and Donnie Iris here in recent years. That seems like that's been a ton of fun, and Donnie's a guy that I think is underrated.
He really is. He's so good, and God bless him. He's battling cancer.
Yeah.
And and he's 83, I think, and he's still rocking, and he loves doing it. And you know, his love for the stage and performing, I think it's gonna help him beat this cancer because he's got this will to live and a big old heart to live. And I really believe that emotionally it has a lot to do with you physically, and I think he's going to do okay. And my son's doing great playing drums for the band, and I show up and as a guest and do a few songs, and it's so fun. Those guys are really great. They're a lot of fun, and the crowd just loves them. And you know, we still have a bunch of shows this year yet, but, you know, he can't do too much yet till he's done with his chemo. And but he's getting through it pretty good. And you know, we're just keeping him in our prayers, you know.
Well, those are fun songs to play, man. And it's just cool seeing you and Joe Jr. out there playing together. So that's got to be a real fun aspect for you as well.
Oh, we have a ball.
Well, just a few other things, man. I'm going to be talking to your old buddy, Peter Frampton, tomorrow. And I wondered, you know, tell me, like, what was the experience of touring with Peter like?
Oh, well, first of all, give him a big hug over the phone for me.
And, I will.
I just love him. He's so amazing. He's so good. And he got stuck back in 77. And they were going through different drummers, and I was friends with Stanley Sheldon, the bass player. And he called me to try to fill in and do a couple of shows with Peter. I said, absolutely. I love Peter Frampton. With Joe Walsh, we did shows with Humble Pie. And I never really knew Peter that well, but I had met him, but we weren't friends or anything. And so, but I knew his music and all that. And when Stanley pulled me into the band, we were supposed to do three shows, and they went quite well. And Peter asked me if I wanted to just do the whole tour with him. I said, hell yeah. He was playing stadiums. Like, these were huge gigs he was doing. And I mean, he was a monster star. And it still is. I'm just saying, back then he had just the Peter Frampton Comes Alive album exploded. And so I got in on about a year after that came out, I got in on the band and was there for a couple of years. And then he took a break and I moved on to other things. But it was an amazing experience working with him. And he was so fun and so good live. Every show was just a joy with him. He made every show a joy. There was never a single thing that was an issue, you know, or road stuff. You know, it was always fun, smiling, playing, kicking ass all the time. And the people just, they still do. They love Peter. And sadly, we lost Bobby Mayo.
Yeah.
He was awesome too. I mean, the whole band was just, I was so fortunate and blessed to get that call, because I never thought I would work with him. I knew him, I respected him, I loved his music, but to get that call and to end up doing a couple of years with him was just an incredible experience. And I went to see Peter last year. He was at the MGM Grand, and we sat and talked for a good hour, and we just had a good time talking and reminiscing, and so my very best to him. I love the man.
So, fellow fans, what is something that they might be interested to learn about Peter's music from the perspective of somebody like yourself that spent a good amount of time immersed in the songs from his catalog?
Every one of his songs is so guitar driven, of course, and they're so thought out, and he was so smart. He designed his, he wrote great songs, but he designed his songs so when you performed them live, you really could pull them off. A lot of times people get in trouble. They go in the studio and they overproduce stuff, or they do stuff that's really difficult to pull off live. And I mean, he was not one of them. He always designed his writing. This is just my perspective. He designed his writing and wrote songs that were great for the studio, but even greater live. And he knew what entertainment ticked, how it ticked, and how it worked. And he would write these great songs, but like I said, he would focus on the recording of them being that, you know. We've all heard songs that are like way too produced to where you need 20 people on the stage to pull it off. And, you know, he wasn't like that. He the way he recorded, Neil Young's a lot like that too. I made a lot of records with Neil Young, and he's the same way. He has a theory. He said, if I can't stand up here and perform this in the studio with you guys, how am I going to do it live? And Peter was the same way. He wrote and performed these songs in the studio, and they were great records. It made great records, but they also made great live performances. And I don't know if he pre-designed that or if he was just thinking that way, but it seemed like when you listen to his records and then you go to see a Peter Frampton concert, he sounds like them records. You know, there's nothing overproduced or underproduced or anything like that. And, that's really, really a gift, because a lot of people make records and they just overdo them sometimes. There's way too much going on. You know, I mean, look at the Beatles. They four pieces and they played live. They sound like the Beatles. That's the way they recorded, you know?
It's a good concept, isn't it?
It is. It's so cool to do that. It's like, and the best songs ever written and recorded were the ones that when you perform them live, they sound even better, you know. And if you have too many parts, then hire some more guys, you know. But you got to be careful not to overdo your records unless you want to have 12 people on the stage, you know.
Speaking of Neil, how much of a fever dream was it doing those Buffalo Springfield shows?
Oh, that was, I had to pinch myself every night. That was unbelievable. Steven Stills called me and said, hey, we're going to do some shows. I said, okay. I mean, I was kind of used to that call. He would call and we're going to go out and either do CSN shows or we're going to do some Steven Stills solo stuff, you know. And he gave me a call. He said, hey, we're getting together. We're going to do some shows. And I said, oh, okay, cool. I didn't think anything of it. I wasn't, you know, I wasn't not excited about it, but I was just like, okay, cool. It's just because I was kind of used to that. And then he goes, I'm going to send you some material to listen to. I said, okay. I was like, I kind of know all your songs, so but go ahead and send the material. And he sent the material, and he sent me the box set of the Buffalo Springfield box set. I said, Stephen, which songs am I supposed to learn there? He goes, all of them. I said, okay. And so then he finally broke the news to me, and it was like, oh my God, I couldn't believe it, because I didn't think they would ever do that, because when I got the call, which was 2011, they had already lost Dewey Martin, and Bruce Palmer had passed away, the bass player and drummer. And so I was like, I never thought that the Springfield would do something like that. But they brought Rick Rosas, who, sadly he passed away, but they brought Rick Rosas, who was Neil's bass player, and they brought me, which I was Steven's drummer. So, and then, and we rehearsed out at Neil's, and sadly, we rehearsed for 2 weeks. There was only 7 shows. And those 7 shows, they sold out in a half hour. The last one being gigantic, which was Bonnaroo. And then Neil had Crazy Horse stuff to do, and he was booked for the summer. And so our last show, I believe, in Bonnaroo was around June the 1st. So we worked May in California. We did a couple at Santa Barbara, a couple in San Francisco, and a couple in L.A. Then we hopped on the plane and went to Tennessee to do Bonnaroo. And that was it. So we had 6-7 shows. And man, it was like, what happened? This was so cool. But Neil had, you know, pre-existing commitments, and they never did rejoin. I was hoping that maybe in the fall that they would get back and want to do it again. It was beyond fun. It was quite an experience. It was historic. This was 2011. Them guys hadn't played live since 1968.
Wow.
Yeah, and so it was a big deal. And like I said, they sold out every show, and these were big places. They sold out every show in a half hour.
Well, I want to close out with 2 song stories. One of the great stories in your book is the story about Long May You Run, speaking of Neil. Can you share that story with our listeners here?
Yeah, okay. The funniest thing I remember about it is I used to smoke cigarettes years and years ago. I don't smoke. It's been many, many years. But the way Neil's pretty loose in the studio, and so we were running through songs to record, and it was just this like slow kind of 2-4 toe tap kind of song in Long May You Run. And so I got a cigarette in my right hand, and I'm sitting at the kit, and he starts playing and singing, and I just start with my left hand, my foot in my left hand, I just start keeping time for the guys, because they were kind of playing it, and he was singing it, and everybody was playing it, all that, and we finished the song, and I think maybe halfway through, I put the cigarette down, grabbed my other stick, because I figured, well, I better get into this, and we were done. When we were done with the song, Neil goes, "That was fantastic. We got it." And I'm like, wait. He said, no, it was great. I said, okay, that's how loose he is.
That's good old school rock and roll, isn't it? That's magic.
That is magic, because I got to tell you, it did come out good, and it was the cut that's, you know, that it went gold, that song in that album. And so it was there was a lot of magic there, and you know, that said a lot to me. It was like, we weren't really trying too hard, you know, we were focused, but we weren't like, okay, we got to get this take and we got to get this, you know, it wasn't like that. We were just very relaxed and just kind of running through it and all that. But if you knew Neil, that's his wheelhouse. He loves recording like that, and that's why his stuff sounds like that, because it's all real natural and laid back and comfortable and smooth, So when we were telling, so I decided I'm not, no more smoking at the drum kit.
That's fantastic, man. Well, we could talk for several years about all your adventures with Walsh, but luckily for people hearing this, it's in your book. But
yeah.
What's the story, man, as far as Rocky Mountain Way? Because that certainly is a fan favorite that just endures to this day.
Well, the I was playing this riff. I came up with that the riff with not the whole song, just that kind of dun 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 dun, you know. And we would jam on that for sound check, because it was a nice thing to jam on. Joe got to play some slide, and we would just, you know, the sound guys always wanted us to play something, and we would play that for a little bit. Then we would do one of the songs from the show. And it got to be really fun jamming on that song, and it got to be where, wow, this thing is pretty cool. But we never, you know, there was no vocal or anything. We were just jamming, and you know, and we got into the studio. We got we were shy one song, and the record label said, "Hey, you guys owe us one more song," and because you know, by you know, your contract says so many songs, and so we owed them one more song on that album. And so Joe said, "Hey, let's do that jam thing we're doing." So we start playing that, and we cut the track, and actually the song that you hear on the radio or wherever you listen to, the cut that was the hit was that was take one. It was our first take, but that's not saying it's because we had been playing it for months on the road. And so we cut this track down in Miami, and then Joe brought the masters out to Colorado, and that's where we finished it. He did the slide and the vocal, and I did some synthesizers on it and some keys, and it came out. That was to us, it was a sleeper track. It was not a throwaway, because it was really cool, but it was just the track that was on the album. It was the last cut we did. We thought maybe Meadows or one of them other songs was going to be the single. When the record label got the masters, they said, "Oh, this Rocky Mountain Way song, that's your single." And we go, "What?" and it was. They were right. And yeah, and so it came out, and it was a big hit for Joe, you know.
Well, what else are you working on that you want folks to know about as we ride out here?
Working on we got after this I'm looking forward to the end of this month. We got this thing in Peoria for Dan Fogelberg, and then I'm headed to Miami for a week to do this rock camp with Roger Daltrey. So I get to play Who songs.
Oh man, that's great.
Yeah, it's gonna be fun. And and then, you know, and I do all kinds of odds and ends, and I'm waiting for Joe to get a break from Eagles and to do some more shows with him. And he always does Vets Aid every year in November, and I've been doing a bunch of those with him, so I keep busy.
Yeah, man, it's been great to watch everything that you've got going on, and I'll plug the website and everything in the intro to this, but Joe, thank you always for the time, man. It's always great to talk music with you.
You too, Matt. Anytime, man.
We've reached the end of another episode of the UCR Podcast. It is Matt Wardlaw. We appreciate you listening. If you enjoy what you're hearing, please rate and review wherever you are listening and hit subscribe so that you'll receive future episodes of the podcast from Ultimate Classic Rock.